The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
That the indictment very clearly makes the case, although it's actually a little lighter on supporting evidence or facts as alleged here than it is on other points, that Trump did this all deliberately. He deliberately gathered this information, deliberately took it out of the White House.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. It's an emergency podcast, June 10th, 2023. You already know it. Donald Trump has been indicted in the Southern District of Florida. The indictment was unsealed on Friday in the afternoon. Special counsel Jack Smith made a brief statement at the Justice Department. He didn't say anything very surprising. He urged everybody to read the indictment. We took him up on that, and we gathered before a live audience on YouTube and in Zoom to talk it over. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio, our Lawfare senior editors, Roger Parloff, Scott R. Anderson, and Stephanie Pell, and Lawfare contributing, I'm not sure what she is right now. She's our Fulton County correspondent who's heading down to Florida to cover the arraignment of Donald Trump for us, Anna Bauer. We have spent the afternoon poring over the indictment, learning stuff about this case, and we are ready to give some preliminary thoughts. Scott, get us started. The indictment, what does it say? What's the deal? Give us a little overview, and as they say in Congress, take such time as the gentleman may require.
Well, I will attempt to do this with some brevity, although it was a challenge because it is a indictment chock full of information. Let me just go and highlight some of the things it gives us that are new, and then I'll go into the structure of the legal arguments and legal charges. On a factual basis, the indictment really lays out, I think, a pretty familiar narrative outlining the fact that the Trump administration, or former President Trump, Trump staff, I should say, removed a set of documents from the White House. Notably, it does allege that he had direct knowledge and involvement in packing up those materials to exit the White House, which has been a point of some doubt as to how much of this was done by him and how much was by his staff. The indictment then describes how those documents were transported to Mar-a-Lago. It has several pages of surprisingly compelling photographs and narrative describing how they were actually held at Mar-a-Lago, which frankly is much worse than has been discussed publicly. For several months, they were held in public on a stage in a ballroom, kind of stacked up. They were then moved to a pool shower and pool bathroom, and eventually found their way to that storage unit that we're somewhat more familiar with in the basement of Mar-a-Lago after going on quite a journey. It also notes that there's actually not just one, but two incidents in 2021 while these documents were being moved around Mar-a-Lago, in which former President Trump acknowledged having classified documents, shared them with third parties, and in both instances indicated he was not supposed to be sharing them and was not supposed to have them. Once is the recorded call with Mark Meadows' team working on his autobiography, or biography, if not autobiography, and a second one's with a political action committee representative later that year, I think in August or September, which appears to be related to the Afghanistan withdrawal, judging from the timing and the subject matter discussed. We then get a pretty detailed account about how Trump and his co-defendant in this matter, Walt Nauta, who was an aide of his both at the White House and afterwards, were involved with another unnamed Trump employee, although I do believe media reporting has identified who he is. The name is escaping me at the moment. I'll double check that. Who were involved in moving these boxes around Mar-a-Lago, bringing them to Trump so he could personally review them before producing boxes back to NARA in January 2022, suggesting that he had direct knowledge of what documents were in there. And then perhaps more relevantly to the charges here, taking these boxes and moving them around the Mar-a-Lago estate in and out of the closet that was being used to store them, because that closet was eventually what was searched by Corcoran, the attorney for the attorney for President Trump, who prepared the statement and collected a subset of the documents to give back to the FBI in response to its subpoena in the middle of 2022. That document said, we searched all the documents for that were provided from brought to Mar-a-Lago from the White House, and this is all we found. That was subsequently proven to be false by the FBI. The strong implication is that Trump knew it was false, and Nauta and the other individual participating in this shuffling of documents knew it was false, and that they were deliberately structuring things to get Corcoran to misrepresent things. In fact, they also quote various points, Trump saying things that strongly suggest, hey, Corcoran, why don't you just get rid of any really problematic documents that eventually show their face? That really is the focus of these criminal charges. Of course, we know that there was an August 2022 search warrant that was eventually executed that identified a number of classified documents. But the charges really center on this subterfuge that happens around this search and representations made to the government. The first 31 charges are each a withholding of classified information, a retention of, of sensitive information, particularly national defense information. It's under the Espionage Act, so it doesn't technically required to be classified, although it often is, but it's the other national defense information. Each one is for a specific document that's described in a fair amount of detail within the indictment. Most of them are documents that were recovered by the FBI on August 8th. About a third of them are documents that were actually handed back by Corcoran in June of that year. But of course, at that point, Trump had had them for a year and a half, and they make the point that he quite knowingly had them because he had reviewed them previously, at least in late 2021, early 2022, and was aware of the contents of these boxes. They then also go through a number of charges that center on the obfuscation and kind of efforts to hide the documents from Corcoran and lead Corcoran to make a false statement to the FBI. This is a conspiracy. While the 31 willful retention charges are about Trump only, from here on forward with the conspiracy, there are also a number of charges for Trump and Nauta alleging that essentially they conspired to try and get Corcoran to file what they knew to be an inaccurate representation to the FBI, saying that they had given all the classified information back. Well, in fact, they had not. And then we have a number of alleged allegations about false statements, specifically by Nauta. He's quoted as having made several false statements about his job, in his role in presenting documents to former President Trump, bringing them to him, and basically indicating in statements to the FBI that he didn't know how Trump might have had prior information about these. Well, in fact, he did. And they have pretty strong evidence, including text messages between him and another staffer indicating that he had direct knowledge of it, often documented by photographs, no less. It's a pretty compelling set of information, much more granular in detail, and frankly, with a lot of substantive material details we didn't have before. There's lots to zoom in on all of that, but I think that's a good enough high-level survey of what we have to get us started in this conversation, at least, and then we can kind of drill in as people are interested, as issues arise.
Excellent. So, Roger, take us from here. What was this indictment like relative to what you were expecting? We've all been expecting it since the beginning of the week, at least, and maybe earlier. Was this the indictment you were expecting, or was there something about it that was either more or less than you were expecting?
It's what I was sort of it's what I was sort of expecting. It tells the whole story, which is a compelling story, and there is more to it, as Scott mentioned, the journey that these documents took between the ballroom and the bathroom and shower of the lake room and the business center and the storage room and then up to Bedminster and then back. And then apparently, if I'm understanding correctly, there were as many as 80 boxes at one point. And as the subpoena is served and as Jay Brad is about to come to the place, they take 60 boxes out and return 30 boxes to the storage room. So there is just more detail. I was a little surprised. Nauta plays a really crucial role, and you can see why they are trying very hard to get him to flip. Evan Corcoran plays a surprisingly important role in terms of proving this. It sounds like he's going to be a very important witness. Other than that, it's interesting. I didn't know they were going to choose 31 documents because typically you're going to have to show those to the jury. 31 documents that are classified, 22 of them are top secret. So I don't know there, you know, there's a couple ways they could do that, but that's going to be an interesting thing to see how that plays out. The several different flavors of obstruction of justice. They aren't going to run afoul of any one court ruling. They don't need to prove corruptly for at least one of those counts. They aren't going to have any problem with some of the other issues that have arisen in the January 6th cases with the 1512C2 count. So, it's pretty much what I had hoped it would be.
All right, so. Roger, make sure you keep yourself muted. Yeah, thank you. All right, so I want to focus on a couple things that are not in there, because in fairness to the former president, there were a lot of rumors swirling around for the last several months that, do not seem to have materialized. One is that there's no whiff of him sharing this material with foreign governments in connection with any business deals of his, right? There's no, Saudi stuff. There's no suggestion that he's selling access to it. Do you think, Roger, that we should assume that's because, whatever he was doing with this stuff, it wasn't that, or that, maybe that stuff is waiting for a superseding indictment. What's your read on the sort of total absence of, document peddling as opposed to document hoarding?
It's speculative. I assume this is what we're going to get. We do have two instances of him disclosing documents. We knew about one from the record that was recorded. There was at least a second. I think the jury might infer that there were other instances. Both of these instances of disclosure remind us all, I imagine, of the incident early in his administration when he disclosed in May 2017 the documents in the Oval Office to the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Sergei Kislyak, the ambassador. They both seem to have been just a way of showing off, showing his power, showing his just a recklessness, and that's what the indictment shows the most. There is one instance where the boxes topple over and the documents spill out, and one of the one of these individuals sees a classified document relating to Five Eyes only, you know, New Zealand, Australia, and UK and US and a fifth, I'm sorry.
And Five Eyes, just to be clear, do not include random visitors to Mar-a-Lago. No, that's more than five, and you know, each of them has two eyes, so it's just not okay.
But I think it's, if he's got more up his sleeve with real espionage, there's no hint of it here.
I'll say also, I don't know if this is the only time we're going to hear, though, of those foreign government contacts, because they do come into play here, which is that the indictment very clearly makes the case, although it's actually a little lighter on supporting evidence or facts as alleged here than it is on other points, that Trump did this all deliberately. He deliberately gathered this information, deliberately took it out of the White House. My suspicion is that that is actually where we see these foreign government contacts and Trump Organization foreign business involvement comes in. Remember, they subpoena Trump Organization records for seven business operations for seven countries going back to 2017, if I recall correctly. My suspicion is that those are seven countries heavily represented these information, and the fact that Trump Organization had business ties there may well play into the idea that there is a motive here for Trump to have collected this information. As to the two incidents where we know there was disclosure of classified information as alleged in this indictment, it is notable no charges specifically relate to that here, but you also probably wouldn't charge those in the Southern District of Florida. Both of them took place in New Jersey. So we may yet see additional charges about that. They appear to mostly have been brought in here as kind of a general context setting about the mistreatment and specifically the knowledge that he was mistreating these documents, not the actual revelation of them as a criminal act.
Yeah, I do think that's a really important point. This is the first set of charges, and it's the set of charges that can only be brought in Florida. I think it is reasonable to expect that there may be additional charges in Washington. Given that there's some activity that relates to Bedminster, I would think there's an outside chance of activity in New Jersey as well. But I think if we're going to get into the judge that this was assigned to in a moment, but if you're the Justice Department or the Special Counsel's Office, you are keen to try this anywhere but Florida if you can. So any charges that don't need to be tried in Florida presumably are not in this indictment. Is that right? All right. I want to turn to Stephanie here. Stephanie has some remarkably relevant expertise to this conversation. First of all, we know Stephanie from Lawfare. Lawfare readers and listeners know Stephanie as a cybersecurity person. But before she was a cybersecurity person, Stephanie, what did you do for a living?
For a number of years, I was a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of Florida. As I like to tell people, I'm old. I started working on doing counterterrorism work even before 9/11 with an IRA, Irish Republican Army gun running case. And then after 9/11, I was ultimately on the trial team that prosecuted Jose Padilla and his co-defendants in the Southern District of Florida.
Okay. Mute yourself when you're not talking, Stephanie. So the relevance of the Padilla prosecution to the current case involves a statute that is going to become very non-obscure all of a sudden, kind of the way FISA did in the early 2000s, called the Classified Information Procedures Act. Explain to us in general terms what CIPA is, why you have experience with it from the Padilla case, and why it is relevant here.
So the Classified Information Procedures Act is essentially a statute that allows the government to know in advance of trial, the threat that prosecuting a particular case would present to the national security of the United States. Basically, when you have a case where the government may need to introduce classified information into evidence, where the defendant may have the right to use this classified evidence as part of his or her defense, when there are discovery obligations. This is a procedural statute that sets out essentially a roadmap of steps where the court can consider how this evidence may be relevant to the defendant, whether he or she should be able to use it, and if so, what kinds of protections the court will put in place to help the government protect the national security of the United States. Now, it is important to recognize, when I keep saying this is a procedural statute, that it in no way can detract from the substantive rights that a defendant would have to a fair trial, or the government's discovery obligations in a case. What it does do is give the opportunity for the government to know how classified information will come into play and actually give the government the opportunity to say, well, you know, the Attorney General can come and say, I do not authorize that information to be disclosed or to be used at trial. And then the court can essentially come back and say to the government, well, if you're not going to do what I say in the sense of follow my order to disclose or allow the use of that classified information, then government, I may dismiss this count. I may require that some facts be introduced on behalf of the defendant, I may strike some counts. So that, in summary, is what SEPA is meant to do. It was relevant in my job many years ago now, because in the Jose Padilla case, it's a different kind of case. It wasn't about classified documents. It was a material support to terrorism case, but this was post 9/11. This involved a group of individuals who were recruiting and fundraising for jihad, and Jose Padilla, I don't even have to say alleged anymore, because we proved
they were all convicted.
They were all convicted. They were all convicted of a number of crimes, probably the main focus being material support to terrorism, and a number of classified issues arose in that case. There was discovery that we needed to provide from intelligence agencies to the defense counsel. There were certain kinds of substitutions pursuant to the Classified Information Procedures Act that we needed to make, again, to fulfill the defendant's right to a fair trial and other discovery obligations. And it is relevant here, again, a very different kind of case, but it is relevant here because the focus of these charges in many respects are involve classified information. And so the government is, I promise you, has thought through how classified information will come into play, but it's going to have to do its discovery. The defense is going to get an opportunity to make arguments that certain kinds of classified information should be provided to the defense and potentially should be used at trial. And this is the statute which the court will use to essentially navigate and make these rulings.
All right. So this is super helpful, and I don't want to compare Donald Trump to Jose Padilla, who, first of all, was never president. Secondly, was meeting with Abu Zubaydah, as I recall, and, you know, planning some kind of a dirty bomb attack. But the same statute governs the classified material, and it's the same court. So here we have 31 classified documents, each with a separate count. The first, as Scott describes, the first 31 counts of this indictment all involve different materials, both at the secret and top secret level. I believe, if memory serves, 22 of them are top secret. So what does the CIPA, the Classified Information Procedures Act, say if you have to prove that Donald Trump willfully retained, you know, a top secret document, which means it's going to contain some kind of intelligence sources and methods, or a secret document, which would be like military plans or, you know, something, you know, like how we're going to attack Iran. That would be secret. And, you know, the source that gives you the information of how to attack Iran, that's top secret, right? So you've got a count, say count 14, just to make one up, that says Donald Trump mishandled this top secret document. What does CIPA say about how you handle the material in count 14? What can you give to a jury of uncleared people? What does the judge have to do? And I know people want to talk about the judge. We're going to get to the judge in a minute. That's why Anna's here. But right now we're talking to Stephanie about the documents, about which none of us know anything, by the way. But we know that they exist because there's 31 counts attached to them. And we have this law that governs how you handle them in the context of a criminal trial. So let's imagine count 14 and a document that's super, super sensitive. What does CIPA say about what the judge, and yes, we're going to get to the judge, is supposed to do with that document?
So to get to that ultimate question, what the judge is going to do, I think it's helpful to start a little bit back further in the CIPA process. The first thing that's going to happen is the government is going to make a motion for a pretrial conference involving CIPA issues, and the court is going to issue a protective order. Because notwithstanding what's eventually going to happen with that particular document for your hypothetical count 14, the documents have to be protected. And you're going to have, I would imagine, defense counsel with clearances in this case who are going to probably get the documents that are at issue in the various counts, certainly count 14. Now, let's say that count 14 involves a document that has some very sensitive information in it. First of all, I would imagine that the government has made, you know, choices about what documents it's going to use, thinking through some of these issues. Now, the government is going to have to prove, if it has alleged that Trump unlawfully withheld a classified document, it's going to have to prove that the document is classified.
And presumably, just to be clear, one of the best defenses, although it's not an ironclad defense, but one of the best defenses, that Trump has here is, sorry, I was thinking about Scott for a different reason and it just came out that way. One of the best defenses Trump is going to have is that these are not properly classified documents that don't in fact include national defense information, right?
So if that's a question to me, not Scott, yes. Although we have to keep in mind that it is the executive's prerogative to classify a document. A court doesn't get to say whether a document is classified or not, right? The government's going to have to prove that it is in fact classified, but whether or not it's appropriately classified is not really a defense in this case. Now, to what's going to happen then with your sensitive document for count 14? One thing that CIPA does allow for is that a document doesn't have to be declassified if it's going to be shown to a jury. The government can make a decision to show a classified document to a jury. That doesn't mean it gets, you know, shown to the press and the public, but that is ultimately a choice the executive has got to make in this case. In addition, the government is going through this SEPA process. The government can request that when the court determines that certain documents are relevant and necessary, then the government can seek to redact certain parts of those documents. I mean, it's only going to have to meet its burden. It's not going to have to exceed its burden. So it may be that that all of the information contained in the document may not be necessary, and the defendant may not be entitled to know for the government to prove the charge. Now, that is, the SEPA process is going to help flesh all of that out. The court is going to be able to make rulings on that. And if the government doesn't agree with the court's ruling, then SEPA provides the opportunity for an interlocutory appeal to, in this case, it would be the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit, you know, can then overrule the district court. The 11th Circuit can affirm the district court. And if the 11th Circuit affirms the district court, let's say the ruling is going to be against the government, this is where the attorney general can decide. Perhaps things would change. I haven't really thought this through, that this is not the attorney general per se, that this is the special counsel. But so let's say the special counsel or the attorney general perhaps would be saying, no, we cannot authorize the disclosure of this information at all. And then the district court would have to figure out how that played into the case. What kind of, ruling would the government then have to live with, be it a dismissal of a count, under extreme circumstances, one could talk about the dismissal of an indictment, but because we're talking about individual documents here, at least at this point, I'm not worried about that kind of outcome.
So is it fair to say that SEPA, I mean, there's two big rights or prerogatives at issue. One is the defendant's right to confront the evidence against him. You can't convict somebody on the basis of secret evidence, period, full stop. The jury's got to see the evidence, and whatever the jury gets to see, the defendant gets to respond to. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, the executive branch has the right to keep secrets. And so SEPA is an effort to mitigate the clash between these these two fundamental principles when you're dealing with crimes that involve classified material somehow. Is that a fair 40,000-foot summary?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the only thing I would add, just focusing on the fact that SEPA is a procedural statute, is that it affords the government to know in advance the potential threat that prosecuting this case will cause, because you'll get individual rulings on these particular classified matters at issue. So it's kind of balancing the rights, substantive discovery, et cetera, rights of the defendant, with the government's right to have advance notice. I mean, nobody should be sandbagged, if you will, at trial. There are procedures where if the defendant, after receiving discovery, chooses or believes that they want to use some of this information in defense at trial, whether that be a document, whether it is eliciting classified information from a witness that may take the stand, the government is giving advance notice of that. The SEPA says, look, If in section 5A hearing, you know, if the defendant doesn't give specific and particular notice, thereby giving the government the opportunity to respond, the court to rule, et cetera, the defendant then cannot just bring that up and sandbag the government at trial.
All right. This is super helpful. Folks, keep your eyes on the SEPA issues. These are going to be the molten core of the pretrial litigation in this case. It's 31 of the 38 counts, I think, and every single one of those counts is going to involve some degree of SEPA litigation. And one of the things that anybody who's covered a national security criminal trial knows, and Stephanie is going to nod her head as I say this, is that SEPA puts enormous power in the hands of the district judge who is, she's nodding her head right now. It puts a real premium on who the district judge is in a given case, because all of these controversies about whether a summary of the material is adequate, whether a redaction is appropriate, all of these questions get mediated by the U.S. District Court judge, who in this case is none other than Judge Eileen Cannon, perhaps the most famous U.S. District Judge in the United States right now, and not necessarily for the best of reasons. Anna Bauer, by the way, also has some unique expertise here. She is one of the small number of people who actually sat through Judge Eileen Cannon's previous 15 minutes of fame. Anna, why is Judge Eileen Cannon a famous person whose name is known throughout the land? Why do we know her name right now?
Well, Judge Cannon is a former prosecutor who was appointed to the bench.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
In the Southern District of Florida by Trump himself, following the FBI search at Mar-a-Lago last summer, as many will recall, Cannon was assigned to preside over the very unusual civil suit that Trump brought, which sought to appoint a special master to review the documents seized by the FBI and effectively sought to enjoin the Justice Department's investigation, at least for some time. And Cannon ultimately granted that request by Trump to appoint the special master and enjoin the investigation. And her order really mangled the law in ways that many legal experts, including those of us at Lawfare, felt was pretty indefensible. And she was ultimately sharply rebuked by a panel of 11th Circuit judges, two of which were Trump appointees as well, and then one Bush appointee. So she's been very controversial because of that background. So it was quite surprising to see this morning to wake up to reports that she'd been assigned to this case as well. And you know, there's been some speculation about whether or not that was appropriate or kind of how that happened.
Yeah. So what do we know about how that happened? You know, was this a random judges on the wheel, the random assignment? Was it because this was a related case to the matter that she grossly mishandled and was all but summarily reversed by the 11th Circuit? Or was this because of something else? How did this one district judge end up supervising, not just supervising and exercising oversight over the Mar-a-Lago investigation, but then presiding over the Mar-a-Lago trial as well?
It seems that it was a random assignment. That is how things work in the Southern District of Florida. Whenever there's a new case that's filed, it is randomly assigned to the 15 active judges or 11 senior status judges within the district. They don't have a rule that, you know, allows for automatic assignment to judges who have worked on related matters. There is a procedure that allows for, you know, transfer to a judge who is working on a still pending related matter. But because the special master litigation has been closed since December, member. I think it's unlikely that process is what led to Cannon being assigned to the case. It seems as though it is just kind of a twist of fate in that the case, it appears, originated from West Palm Beach, not from Miami, even though the grand jury sat in Miami and the case was filed in Miami. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's kind of where they're going to choose the eligible judges from. So it seems that she was eligible as a judge who sits in a neighboring county. That's kind of how they do it in the Southern District, is they just choose either a judge in the division where the case originated or someone who's, you know, nearby. And she sits in Fort Pierce, and that's right next to West Palm Beach. So it appears that it just happened to randomly work out like that. You know, it's surprising, but as we all know, in Trump world, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
Okay, Stephanie, I want a reality check on that. You have practiced as a federal prosecutor in that court. How plausible to you is it that this was randomly assigned to, of all people, Judge Eileen Cannon?
I feel like you're setting me up, but
no, I am open to any answer to this. I have covered law and federal investigations in the District of Columbia for many years, and I remember when every single case, no matter how obscure, anything that I wanted to write about was always assigned to Royce Lamberth, and so I'm willing to believe anything. I'm just looking for somebody with local practice experience to tell me whether to take this idea seriously, that there's a 1 in 15 chance that the same district judge who just monumentally fucked up the case last summer, I mean, just cosmically blew it, gets assigned the entire criminal case. Should I take that at face value?
Yes, at least for now, until we know more. And why do I say that?
Okay, your word is gospel to me. I'm just it's improbable.
So there actually is an answer to this, but I was looking, if you thumb through, I printed out the indictment, and if you look at there's paperwork after the formal indictment is ended, and there is a page that is signed by Jay Bratt that says, and he with the title Assistant Special Counsel, and it asks the person filling out the document to mark off the court division, to check one, and West Palm Beach was checked off. So then, Anna, I didn't count, like, I don't remember, or I hadn't looked at how many judges are currently in that West Palm Beach area, but you're starting from a smaller group than the entire district. So if you're marking West Palm Beach, there aren't as many district judges in West Palm, just part of the Southern District of Florida, than in the Miami division, or I believe even in Fort Lauderdale. I think it is, until we know more, I think it is plausible.
All right. Plausible, but Roger, you were saying in our editorial meeting that you think this is I think the word you used was catastrophe for Jack Smith, the special counsel. Walk us through why this judge assignment gives you I'm not sure if the right word is heartburn or something more serious with respect to one's heart.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Well, as for the reasons Stephanie described earlier when she was talking about SEPA, I mean, all federal judges have an enormous impact on the trial and evidentiary decisions. But in a SEPA case, they're making crucial decisions about how you handle all these documents. And there are some very delicate questions. She's a very new judge. I'd be very surprised if she's handled one of these before. And then we have this exceedingly odd experience that Anna just described. And it's not just, it's not that she's a Trump judge. There are, you know, I've been watching the January 6th cases in Washington. There are a lot of Trump judges in D.C. who are ruling exactly the same way as the non-Trump judges. That's not in, and I think also the 11th Circuit ruling that Anna described, there was at least all three of those judges were Republicans, and I think at least one was a Trump appointee. That's not it. There was something exceedingly odd about her approach to that case, and it augurs ill. But in addition, I was also concerned about. I mean, I guess they must have had no choice in terms of venue. That's what they decided. But in terms of the jury, you know, I imagine it will be about six and roughly, I imagine half the populace is Republican. And so I would assume, looking at what's going on politically, that maybe 40% of those would be Trump supporters. To be a Trump supporter at this stage means that you have rebuffed a lot of information about this guy, and it has, you have considered it irrelevant. You know, there were three obstruction of justice charges that Mueller said were provable, that obviously Trump's attorney general chose not to pursue, but you might think that might give you pause. There was then the call to Zelensky demanding a favor in exchange before he would release $400 million, a personal favor, a campaign favor, before he would release $400 million. That sounds like two other felonies. It sounds like solicitation of a bribe. It sounds like solicitation of a foreign campaign contribution. Again, Bill Barr swept that under the rug. But then eventually he asked Bill Barr to do things that Bill Barr was unwilling to do, to help him commit basically new crimes. And Bill Barr resigned. And of course, we got January 6th. There was so, you know, Trump supporters are resilient when it comes to facts that suggest that Trump might have done something wrong. And if you're going to, and you need a unanimous jury, and I don't see how you do it. I mean, it's a very strong indictment. Maybe I'm being cynical, but that's also a concern.
Okay, so I want to go to Scott for a counterpoint. But before I do, Roger, I just want to challenge you on something about what you just said, which is, you know, hey, in the District of Columbia, lots of January 6th people have filed motions that say, I can't get a fair trial here because everybody is a Biden supporter. There are too many Democrats in the District of Columbia. And so, you know, the jury pool is hostile to me. Aren't you saying the same thing, just in the other direction?
In essence, yes, but but it's also the reality. You know, O.J. Simpson walked for a reason, I don't think he would have walked in any forum. The forum makes a difference. The venue makes a difference, and this is going to be a difficult one. And There's another distinction I would make, and which no one will accept, which is that, you know, a jury needs to be fact-based. I don't think a lot of Trump supporters at this stage are fact-based. Obviously, that's my opinion. But I think to still support this guy after what we've seen is a cult. And it goes beyond, you know, what your voter registration is. It's a commitment to this guy that goes beyond the facts.
But Roger, you know, the rules of venue, and I'm going to pitch again Brandon Van Grack's article about venue in the Mar-a-Lago matter in Lawfare from a number of months ago. The rules of venue say you don't get to evaluate what you think of the jury pool or whether you think they're fact-based. Venue has to do with where the crime happened. Are you arguing that it's a regrettable reality that venue has to be in South Florida, or are you arguing that it is a mistake on Special Counsel Smith's part to bring the case there?
I assume it's a regular, it's a unfortunate reality that they analyzed the venue and they thought, and you know, frankly, that was, when I was just as an amateur looking at the venue, what I could find out about it, 793E, retention, willful retention of classified documents, it does appear to occur in the Southern District of Florida. You know, there were ways to try to get around that by charging conspiracy, but they might have been too cute, and you know, appellate judges, district judges, everybody would have seen through that. So I assume he made the right call, but
you're worried about it.
I'm worried about it.
And are you more worried about the jury pool, or are you more worried about Judge Eileen Cannon?
Oh, well, that's a that's a close call. I'm worried about both.
All right, Scott, you have a softer view of Judge Cannon than Roger does. You're prepared to, as people keep making fun of me about, with respect to some other people, giving her the benefit of the doubt. What is the case that Judge Eileen Cannon is misunderstood, and we should be tolerant of her and give her a chance?
So I'm not going to go that far in terms of, you know, giving her the benefit of a doubt necessarily. But I also don't know if even her kind of priors are necessarily mean they're fatal. Her being the judge would be fatal to this case. The simple truth is that the special master litigation that happened towards the end of last year was exceptionally weird in a number of regards. There was very kind of loose precedent. A lot of it was about equitable jurisdiction, concepts of equity, treatment of particular suspects. And it wasn't about the final disposition of the case. Remember, it really was about access to information for investigatory purposes and on a particular timeline, you know, whether it goes through a special master process or not. I wasn't surprised to see a young, relatively inexperienced judge act super, super small C conservatively when you're dealing with a high profile, politically charged case where a former president is the former defendant. It doesn't justify it. I think she was wrong on the law, pretty blatantly wrong. A few times she was like aggressively wrong. And that's not a good way to behave. She was slapped pretty firmly about it by the 11th Circuit on appeal. She also faced ethics charges. All the 11th Circuit's chief judge eventually, you know, dismissed those as I understand it over it. So all I would say about this is that the law around a lot of aspects of this prosecution, not all of them, but a lot of them, is just clear cut. You know, you have the SEPA issue. I think that's a significant one. You have attorney-client privilege issues in regards to the M. Evan Corcoran testimony that appears to feature prominently in the indictment. Those are two big legal questions on which a number of these charges hinge, but not all of them, especially when you have 31 different counts to work through on different docs. So, you know, I'm just not sure there's as much space here for the priors and equitable perspectives of the judge to fill in if she is somebody who at least feels confined to some extent by the law. And I think her experience, at least on appeal in the last case, if not her entire legal career, will suggest that, yeah, she probably does feel confined by the law. Like the 11th Circuit certainly reined her in on a panel of Republican-appointed judges, including Trump judges. So I'm just saying I don't think it's reason to assume this is a futile exercise at this point, although I was not excited to see that she might be the judge, which, again, I think is still TBD exactly. I would just make a quick note on the jury pool. Juries are not, as Roger Wells knows, I'm not saying he's suggesting this, but it's worth bearing in mind, they're not selected randomly from the population of a state. They are selected through a process from a random pool from the population around where the court trial is being held. But there are things the prosecution and the court can do to try and winnow out people who have strong priors on particular candidates. That will be hard when you're talking about something as high profile as this. No one should, you know, ignore that. But it's certainly possible. And I think there'll be a lot of tools, the prosecution and the court, particularly if you have a judge acting in good faith, that's where the two issues kind of intersect, can do to try and get a jury pool that will handle the matter fairly, even in jurisdictions that on a pure distributional basis, you may think have strong priors. So I wouldn't rule that out. That said, you know, you do only need one person to hang a jury. And that is a
okay. We are going to go to audience questions.
About very carefully when they decided
we only
they
have time for a couple of them. So I apologize to the many of you whose excellent questions we're going to have to skip. Joyce, you get the first question today.
Thank you. You've already mentioned the two incidences of dissemination of classified information that have not been charged in the indictment. There's been some public reporting that the documents related to those dissemination events have not been found. And Brendan Van Grack postulated this afternoon that that's the reason that those two incidences were not charged. Apparently, there's not enough information to get a search warrant for Bedminster and Trump Towers, other Trump properties where these documents might be. The question becomes, how do we get back potentially live and damaging national security information that might still be floating around out there, barring the ability to get a search warrant? Do we need a law? Do we need some facility to do that?
All right, who has thoughts on this question? Scott, take it away.
Yeah, they're very good questions. You know, the process that you're going to see to get these documents back is the same process we saw in Mar-a-Lago. The Justice Department wouldn't do this for everybody, but with a former president, even one who has not treated them well before, they're first going to subpoena them, and then they'll do a search warrant. We don't necessarily know there hasn't been a subpoena in Bedminster. We didn't find out about the subpoena in Mar-a-Lago for several months after it was negotiated, right? This is something that could be discussed in close quarters. A lot of different accommodations might've been reached about a particular search or other conditions. And it was a case where in the Mar-a-Lago case, they appear to very clearly have investigated and frankly got a witness who clarified, oh yeah, there's still classified documents there. You don't say that in the indictment, but you don't have to read very closely between the lines to tell there was something that led them to think the subpoena was not totally responsive or that they had not fully responded to it. Maybe they couldn't get the same thing in Bedminster, but you know, the investigation isn't over. I don't think a new law is necessary. I think there are plenty of laws on the books. Enforcing them just takes time and it's a process and it's not something we all see all the parts of. In terms of charging those two disclosures, not finding the underlying document might have been an issue, but I doubt it's going to be a long-term issue. It may have been not been an issue in terms of the timeline on which they want to prosecute this case. Certainly in the case of the Bedminster memo for regarding former chairman Chief of Staff Milley knew the memo. He talked about it. He talked about it to the press after the fact, or reportedly it was reported in the press as having talked about it with the grand jury and others. I'm confident they can find that memo. Maybe they can't bring it before a jury or someone else, but they can find it. They may not have found it in Trump's documents. That might be a good reason to search Bedminster and a reason that they may be pursuing additional investigatory steps. those additional investigatory steps could lead to prosecution again. They're going to prosecute those disclosures absent some overarching theory that would have linked them to this action in Mar-a-Lago to Washington, D.C., which if they had that theory and they were confident, we probably would have seen these charges brought in Washington, D.C. Because they're not relying on that, they're going to have to bring those charges in New Jersey. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that still happens at a later stage.
All right. We have a question from Jared on a related matter. Jared, the floor is yours.
So I've got two questions, and hopefully you'll be able to get to them. The first one is, and you've kind of partially answered this, but why would Smith not have charged Trump for the removal of documents from the White House? Are there circumstances under which, are the circumstances under which they were removed just maybe too nebulous? And the second has to do with Nauta. He seems to have been in the Navy when Trump left, as Nauta being part of the White House kitchen, and voluntarily transferred with Trump. The next thing that I seen about his employment was joining Trump's official offices in August. There's a few months there where maybe he was still in the Navy. Could he potentially face UCMJ charges for mishandling documents while he was still in service to the armed forces?
Okay, Roger, you have thoughts on some portion of this?
Yeah, the first portion. I think that, you know, if the documents are shipped out on January 18th, he's still president. And so I don't think he commits a crime until he retains them on after noon January 20th. I think plotting to do it is it's not this crime. They don't charge conspiracy to retain or to smuggle national defense information out of the White House. So I don't think that pulling the documents out of the White House is a crime. If it were, that, you know, the venue would be in D.C. That would be easy. As far as Nauta, I really don't know. Can't address that.
I do know in the case of Nauta, which is that when he is the gravamen of the actions that he's involved in take place, as Scott described earlier, in connection with activity at Mar-a-Lago when he is in the employ of Donald Trump and the Trump Organization at Mar-a-Lago, not when he is in the Navy. And so it is possible, I suppose, had this been investigated by the Navy criminal investigation group, that they would have focused on his activity as a service member, but that is not the way it was investigated, and it is not the way it's charged. It's charged as the activity reflects his activity as a civilian in civilian, not even in government employ, except for a small part of it at the beginning, for which I believe he is not charged. The charges against Nauta are all related to his activity at Mar-a-Lago. And so while I suppose a Navy criminal investigation could have come up with something different, the charges that he is accused of could only be charged, I think, in his capacity as a civilian. I will also say one other thing related to the first question, that effectively there is no difference between charging for the removal and charging for the retention. They both involve the same conduct, which is intentionally removing and keeping these documents. One focuses on the intentional removal and the other focuses on the keeping, but it's really the same act. whether you charge it way X or way Y. And I do think it would be in an unseemly fashion, duplicative, though probably lawful, to charge both. That is, charge the same act twice under the same statute, one as the removal and one as the retention. I think you could probably get away with it, but it would be cheap and it would be prosecutorial, kind of like throwing spaghetti at the wall. And I think it's classy of Jack Smith not to do it, actually. Scott, do you have thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, just very briefly. I don't disagree with Roger's point, but I would put a different light on it about the fact that he's president. It's different. A big part is also witnesses are going to be harder to get because everything that they're going to try and get testimony from White House officials working for Trump on this is going to be at least have some colorable claim of executive privilege. Now, a lot of that should be pierceable in a criminal investigation, but it's going to take a lot of time to litigate that out probably. And it's going to be kind of a painful process. So I suspect that's an investigation that couldn't go at the pace they wanted to do. They clearly were looking into this. Again, the indictment very clearly says this is deliberate action on Trump's part on the front end from the outset to pack this stuff together, direct him to do it. It's light on details, but I don't know if that means they've necessarily ruled it out. Again, we could see charges about this in Washington, D.C. They are choosing to only charge the Florida-based conduct in these cases. Parts of these can come back. Ben's point about the duplicative charge of 793 is there. There are other provisions of 793 you could charge for unlawfully removing the documents that wouldn't be 793E, that could be separate charges. So that might come into play as well. Not to mention other people might be involved in the conspiracy at some point earlier. The only conspiracy we're seeing alleged here is about deceiving the FBI. If there was a broader effort to pack and remove these classified materials in a way that was going to be unlawful when the president left and everybody knowingly participated in that, there might be other actors in the different conspiracy that could be charged there. So I wouldn't rule out the fact that there might yet be DC charges. I think it's just a harder thing to investigate, and they clearly wanted to move this thing along on a timely basis, as we heard the special counsel say today in his press conference.
Yeah, just to be clear, I don't think it would be duplicative to charge a conspiracy in DC that incorporates a whole lot of activity, including the removal. But I think if you've already charged the retention in Florida, charging the removal that is essentially the same conduct, you know, he stole and kept documents. So you charge the and kept in Florida and the stole in DC. That feels cheap to me. And I honestly hope they don't do it, not because it would be unlawful or inappropriate, but because it would be piling on in a way that I think is honestly beneath federal prosecutors. And I like it when they have the confidence to, you know, charge one fact pattern once and not figure out a way to charge it five times. I want to close with a question to Anna Bauer, who is shortly to get on a plane and fly down to Miami to cover the arraignment of Donald Trump for Lawfare. Anna, first of all, are you going to sleep on the streets in front of the federal courthouse in Miami or in Palm Beach to get a seat? What are you willing to go through in order to be in the courtroom when Donald Trump is arraigned? And secondly, but by far less importantly, what are you looking for? What are you looking to see when this hearing takes place on Tuesday?
Thanks, Ben. Yes, I do plan to sleep outside of the federal courthouse in Miami if needed. As we discussed earlier, I think that...
I want to make clear, Lawfare does not demand this of you.
Yes, I should say Ben specifically told me that I am not expected to sleep outside of the federal courthouse in Miami. But I said, well, you only get a presidential arraignment once in your life, or in my case, maybe twice if Fulton County makes some moves in August. So I'm very excited to be there and to cover it for Lawfare. What I'm looking for, I think something that I'm interested to see is how Trump's new legal team performs. You know, whenever I've covered the Trump special master litigation, it's been mainly Jim Trusty, you know, Chris Keist.
Jim Trusty doesn't like you very much.
He does not like me. Yeah, he was not happy with some of our coverage. But I am very excited to see kind of some new lawyering in the mix on his team and to see kind of, you know, whether that is a different style, if it is a little bit more serious and less blustery in tone. So we'll see. And then, you know, I'm just kind of interested to see what it's like to be in that room. You know, I wasn't there when he was arraigned in Manhattan, and I hope to be there if he is arraigned in Fulton County. And so I think that having, you know, this experience of seeing what it's like in federal court will really inform some of our future reporting on Fulton County as well.
We are going to leave it there. Anna Bauer, Stephanie Pell, Roger Parloff, Scott R. Anderson, you are all great Americans, and thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a emergency edition of the Lawfare podcast. You know, we don't do the usual outros with the emergency podcasts, but we do say that this Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineers this episode are the great Anna Hickey on the YouTube side and the incomparable Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo on the podcast side. Folks, if you noticed that Joyce and Jared got to ask questions today, that is because they are material supporters of Lawfare, and you too should become a material supporter. Join the live conversation, not merely the projection onto YouTube of the live conversation. Become part of the community. Our editor is, as always, the one, the only Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening. Okay, we are done for now. We will be back, folks. I'm inclined to do a bunch of the podcasts over the next week or so live on YouTube. So keep an eye out for announcements. We will do these whenever we can. As a general matter, we're going to reserve the Zoom for material supporters, but the YouTube, we will always do live available to the general public. So come join us again. And now we are going to disappear and finish Lawfare's written content for the evening, which should go up in the next couple hours. Thank you all for joining us.